You are listening to South by Southwest Sessions.
Hello, Renika.
Hi, Deborah. How are you?
Good. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. I've been an admirer of the work that you've done for many, many years, so I'm excited to learn from you today.
Thank you.
I know that we're still in the middle of this pandemic, but it's a good time to pause and think about why and how communities of color have been disproportionately impacted by this global pandemic. And when we first started hearing confirmation that Black people and communities of color were disproportionately impacted, I thought of an old saying that when America catches cold, Black people get pneumonia. And we saw that play out, not because Black people or people of color were disproportionately susceptible, some type of innate susceptibility to coronavirus, but because the virus was introduced into this legacy, years of inequality. The virus is introduced into systems that were discriminatory in individual, systemic, and structural ways. So if we could start with talking about some of the reasons why, help us break down the systems that caused Black people and people of color to be disproportionately impacted by the virus.
Sure, I can talk to you about that. So first, I'll be focusing on data around Black communities. And in part, that's because the data for Latinx communities and Indigenous communities is just shamefully lacking. So the data on these communities for Latinx and Indigenous communities, where we do have that data, so for example, in New York City, they are reporting, collecting and reporting data on Black communities and Latinx communities, and we are seeing disparities. So for example, in New York City, Black people are dying at twice the rate of whites who contract COVID-19, and Latinx communities are dying at 1.5 times the rate of white communities. At the same time, for the areas like New Mexico that are collecting information on Indigenous communities, we're seeing mortality rates that are 8 times as high as white mortality rates. In Arizona, the Indigenous mortality rate is 5 times the rate of all other groups. So when we talk about that, and we think about that, I just want to, as we go through this conversation, as we are talking about the impact on Black communities, that we're also keeping that in our minds as well. And so for Black communities, they've been segregated in both where they live and where they work. We also know that overcriminalization of Black communities is contributing to higher rates, so that we see Black communities where disparities were first being reported at the first wave of the pandemic. And this is in Michigan and Illinois and Louisiana, where the rates of mortality for Black people were much higher than for whites. These are the same states that have higher rates of incarceration for Black people. So for example, in Michigan, Illinois, and Louisiana, they are incarcerated. More than half of the prison population is Black. And this far exceeds their proportion of the populations of these states. And so we know that prisons and jails are hotbeds of infection because people simply can't social distance in those communities. We know that they don't have access to adequate cleaning supplies, which means that they can't wash hands, they can't sanitize. And even once the virus is present, we also are seeing lack of adequate access to healthcare. So what's true for the general public is even more true in prisons. In terms of jobs and what we think about occupational segregation. So we know that Black people are more likely to be in the essential jobs that are frontline workers. So that might be nursing homes, that might be the factory workers, food service and food delivery. Those are the things that we're thinking about, and those are the ways that we're seeing that Black communities are having higher rates of exposure, and that they are not able to take off leave because they don't have sick leave, and they're less likely to have health insurance in those low-wage jobs as well. So those are some of the ways that we're seeing the higher rates of infection and mortality in Black communities. And so this is the environment that we find ourselves in.
And not only are we seeing higher rates of infection, I think we've also seen that Black people and other people of color are have less access to healthcare, less likely to go see a doctor when they start to show symptoms. Some of that, I think, is because of longstanding structural issues, underfunding of community hospitals, of social safety net hospitals, a history of mistrust between people of color and the medical profession. Can you talk a little bit about how that has played into it?
Sure. So we know early on, we were hearing reports from all over, just a real distrust of public health facilities. There's a history in the Black community of discrimination and the denial of healthcare. For those not familiar, there was the Tuskegee experiment where Black patients who contracted syphilis were denied treatment and care solely because they wanted to see how the disease, if it were left untreated, what kind of symptoms would develop. And for the participants in that study, they were not told that they were being denied treatment. And this went on for decades before this treatment was acknowledged. And the result was that people died. And we have a history of those kinds of experimentation with the Black community that leads to deep distrust. And at the same time, we know that even for Black people who do go to hospitals, who do go to doctors, that they have worse outcomes even for the same conditions. So we're seeing, you know, there's data that shows even when they're treated by the same doctor with the same condition, that they're more likely to have a worse outcome. That's about bias, that's about implicit bias, both at the individual level of the healthcare provider, but also about systemic disparities and discrimination that we're also seeing. Mm-hmm.
So just to shift a little bit, what do you think is going to be the long-term impact on communities of color? We have some conversations in the general society about there's going to be no return to normal, that society has been changed for forever. And I'm sure that communities of color are going to be transformed because of this. In housing, many states have rent moratoriums or eviction moratoriums that are about to expire or have expired, but still there are folks who can't afford their current rent, much less their back rent. And we have many children of color who were unable to fully access their right to education. They're gonna go back to school in the fall, having had very little summer enrichment and no way to really close that achievement gap. And it's just going to widen. Can you talk a little bit more about the permanent mark that this pandemic is gonna have in the communities you've talked about?
Sure. So I'll say that we are still absolutely in the learning phase in terms of what the long-term impacts will be. But here are some things that we already know. We know that the economic impact has been devastating. And so what we're seeing in terms of who is unemployed and who's had either interruptions in income or is still not receiving income, that the numbers of unemployed disproportionately are Black people. For example, Black women make up the single largest sector of unemployed workers. And that data only doesn't necessarily capture workers in the gig economy who are not classified as employees. And so we know that's a problem. We also know that obviously, or not maybe not obviously, but for many Americans, they're literally one paycheck away from a catastrophic financial loss. And they don't have more than $400 worth of savings going into this pandemic. And so what that means is that the loss of income can mean immediate concerns about food insecurity, about housing instability. And we're also seeing this in terms of small business owners. So in the pandemic, you know, I think of it as the earthquake and off the coast, and then the tsunami is the economic impact. And so what we're seeing, small businesses during the wave of shutdowns, we saw 22% of small businesses close. And when we compare that to the Great Recession, for the entire Great Recession, we lost 5% of small businesses. So just in terms of the comparison, in 2 to 3 months, we lost 22%. And those numbers were even more dramatic for Black and Latinx businesses. We saw 41% of Black businesses close. We saw 32% of Latinx businesses close. And so what we've seen in past crises, we saw this after Katrina, we're seeing this now, is that Black and Brown communities are left out of the recovery and consideration for how the aid needs to be provided. And one example of that is in the CARES Act, which is the congressional law that Congress passed that pushed out billions of dollars of aid. There was created the Paycheck Protection Program, which was intended to provide support and relief for small businesses and their employees. And this was billions of dollars worth. And every small business was supposed to be eligible for this. And yet what we saw is that the Small Business Administration in its implementation adopted exclusions for small business owners with criminal records, for small business owners who are facing pending charges, even where they hadn't been convicted. And so the ACLU has filed a lawsuit on behalf of individual business owners and organizations supporting individuals with criminal records. And two of our clients, Saquon Merritt and John Garland, both had small businesses. Mr. Merritt has an electrical contracting business in Maryland. Mr. Garland has a sign making business in New York. And they each were denied PPP loans for their businesses and for their workers. And so they've had to interrupt payments and not been able to pay their workers. They've had to rely on family because they already faced, you know, the fact of being a Black business owner, the fact of having a criminal record, had difficulty obtaining financing from banks. And so what we're seeking in this lawsuit is the elimination of any exclusions, because Congress said that this money is supposed to be for all businesses. And what we don't want, but what we absolutely see happening, is the same communities that came into the pandemic behind will fall even farther behind. So that's a huge concern we have about the long-term impacts of this.
Can you mentioned some of the clients that the ACLU has. Can you talk about the work that you're doing now to address some of the disparities that we're seeing, the immediate fires that are there, but also the long-term impact and kind of doubling down on inequality that we're gonna see?
Sure. So we've been working on two fronts, as you said. So there's short-term, we're trying to save lives. So the ACLU and its affiliates have filed more than 50 lawsuits seeking the release of vulnerable individuals from jails and prisons. And so these are people who have pre-existing conditions, people who are older, people who were slated for release, people who are being held solely because they cannot pay and have not been convicted of any crime. And so we have lawsuits all over the country where we're trying to get people out of jails in prison, because we know that that they are much more likely to get deathly sick. They're much more likely to die if they're in prison or in jails when they contract COVID-19. So we have pushed out and done an extraordinary amount of work to try to make those releases happen where appropriate. At the same time, we're still looking at the root causes of these issues, and we're thinking about sort of basic core democratic rights in the midst of this pandemic and ensuring that those are protected. So we've got lawsuits that are protecting the voting rights of the communities that are hardest hit. We think for many communities, voting safely by mail will be necessary. And so we filed lawsuits protecting the right to vote by mail and ensuring that that isn't an obstacle to people exercising their constitutional right to vote. So we're thinking about these different pieces of the puzzle in the short term. And then for the longer term, we want to really get at the root causes as well. And that we've been working on thinking about segregation in housing, this residential segregation that is really at the root cause. We're trying to move forward and develop strategies and continue with strategies that we think will open up access to housing, ensure that we're living in more inclusive communities, and that we don't have Black people who are able to be easily policed, are able to be easily denied quality schools, able to be denied housing and transportation. The things that we know are part of the drivers of the disparities that we're seeing in COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about the work that you did to have folks released from jails and prisons. One thing that's fascinated me about that work and the result was that we're using tools that are already there, that we've had those tools all along. So we talk about mass criminalization and mass incarceration and trying to reduce our jail populations. Right. And some people say it's so hard. But here we see that there were tools that were already there that were used in a matter of weeks. What does that say to you about, I don't know, where there's a will, there's a way, or kind of the resistance we get to fighting for racial equality?
Right. There's no question that we're seeing with adequate motivation, what we are capable is amazing. I mean, the fact that we were able to push out literally billions of dollars in aid in a matter of weeks, that we, you know, there's obviously much more that can be done and could have been done, but at the same time, we've been able, we've seen thousands, literally thousands of people across the country released from jails, and it makes you wonder, why were they in jails in the first place? Well, we know that there are racial disparities and that our criminal justice and criminal legal system are completely outsized. We know that over 10 million arrests that are made each year, that only about 5% of those are for serious, serious crimes. And that most of the policing that is happening in segregated Black and Brown communities. And that the policing that they're being subjected to, and these are the protests that we're seeing across the country, and people are fed up and they won't take it anymore. And I think the response to the deaths of George Floyd, of Breonna Taylor, of Tony McKay, these are the fire this time, but really these are struggles that people have been fighting and pushing for and seeking recognition. And so I think we are seizing this moment and trying to push forward. And I think we also recognize the deep history here. I think one other piece that we have been fighting for and pushing for is to recognize the legacy of racism that goes back generations to this country's origins with slavery. And we in the ACLU has been supporting the passage of H.R. 40, which is the House bill to establish a commission on reparations and to examine the ways in which the legacy and the history of discrimination stemming from slavery continue to affect all of us today, and not just Black communities, but it really distorts our democracy and it denies an equal opportunity for all of us.
Mm-hmm. What work can we do to make sure that some of these pretty remarkable changes that we saw are permanent? So we've seen a kind of embrace of vote by mail and hope that that stays. We've seen pushback against cash bail and compassionate release. How do we make sure that these become everyday parts of our society as opposed to kind of tools we pull out during a crisis?
Sure. I think what we have to do is we have to reject the premise that Black people are criminals. We have to reject that the way that we address many problems is through policing and jailing of our citizens. The U.S. imprisons more people than any other country in the world. And so we need to think about, how do we build communities that are thriving? How do we approach this saying we won't leave anyone behind? We'll say that we are all going to get free together. Like, we're going to do this as a community, as a group. And I think some of what we're seeing and the legacy of what we're seeing is about discomfort with those that aren't like us. We see in, you know, these instances, in Central Park, with the Karens world, like, what we're seeing is people reacting, not just the George Floyd and the policing and the police brutality that we're seeing and outraged by, but really this questioning of people living their daily lives because they're making someone uncomfortable. And we need to be able to recognize that we are all going to live together and that we can't solve our problems by calling the police. We can't solve our problems by criminalizing Black people in particular. And that we need to reckon with our history, and we need to acknowledge that until we do that, we're not going to be able to move forward.
So just picking up on the kind of ubiquitous image of Black people as excessively criminal, or excessively violent in the way that that drives so many of our laws and policies. In connection with the work that you all have done at the ACLU to have folks released from jails and prisons, one of the challenges has been that those folks were released into a system where there are laws and rules and regulations and policies that pose barriers to their successful reentry in the best of times. And here we are in the worst of times, where those folks are getting released into communities that are struggling, that have lack of resources, where the organizations that form the social safety net for them are stretched very thin. And so one of the challenges is, how do we make sure that folks who are being released are successfully re-embraced by their communities? And one of the challenges, and I know you've been doing work on this, are crime-free housing ordinances and other policing-based housing policies that make it difficult and complicated for people to successfully re-enter their communities. Can you talk first about what are crime-free housing ordinances and policing-based housing policies, and a little bit how they have complicated the efforts to get folks released early from jails and prisons during the pandemic?
Sure. So crime-free housing ordinances are they're essentially municipal laws that are passed, often pushed by law enforcement, police, sheriffs, and they require landlords to either deny tenant applications by folks with not just criminal records or convictions, but they might even have, again, arrest records. And these, we know the disparities in arrest, the racial disparities are extremely high, and we know that many arrests don't lead to any conviction. Mm-hmm. And so these crime-free housing ordinances put law enforcement in the decision-making chair of who is able to access housing. And so landlords are required to sign these, and the ordinances might obligate the landlord to deny a rental application from someone who has had contact with the police. They might require the landlord to evict a tenant. And so what we've seen, we have litigation in Minnesota challenging one of these crime-free housing ordinances. And what I'll say is, like, our case is in Minnesota, but we know that crime-free housing ordinances have been adopted in over 2,000 jurisdictions around the country. And that they, in Minnesota, the crime-free housing ordinance was passed not in a response to higher rates of crime. It was the crime-free housing ordinance was adopted in response to more Black people moving in. There was an increase in Somali refugees moving into the town as well. And the response was to criminalize them and to deny them and to require landlords to sign these crime-free housing contracts that essentially required landlords to deny housing or to evict tenants. And we have clients who were denied either because of their criminal record or because the police were called to their homes. And we know, again, from the recent reporting that that can happen solely because your neighbor is uncomfortable with you, because the neighbor doesn't know you and is questioning the legitimacy of the Black people in their community. And so that's part of why we're challenging. What it does is it moves the overcriminalization of Black communities, and it creates a tag. It creates an extending barrier that isn't just about contact with the police, but follows you far after, if you are convicted of a crime, far after you've been released. And so this affects the folks we're trying to get out of jail now, who, you know, we know in some instances never should have been in there in the first place. But even for people who have served their time, they are entitled to a second chance, and they are entitled to re-enter their communities with no restraints. They have paid their debt, and we want them to be successful. We want them to thrive and succeed. And I'll take us back to our clients who are running small businesses. They're creating jobs. They're creating services and products for their communities, and that's exactly what we want. And so we're challenging the crime-free housing ordinances as discriminatory, and we're pushing back on the adoption of these ordinances because they do bring a convergence of the overcriminalization of Black communities, as well as the denial of affordable housing and the ability to join communities that have all of the supports and resources that are ideal for people to be healthy, for people to be economically secure, for people to be educated. And so we're continuing to work to challenge these ordinances. You're on mute.
Sorry, shift a little bit. We have some great questions from the folks who are listening in. So I'm going to turn to some of those questions. And the first is, how can distinctions be made between racism and other causes of discrimination and inequality? I assume the person speaking about class or gender or other aspects of discrimination, so that attempted solutions don't exacerbate problems they're trying to solve.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, one of the things to remember and that we've thought about in terms of our response to the COVID-19, for example, one of the things we pushed for early on, so in April, we, in coordination with a number of our affiliates, pushed for better collection of demographic data. And so there were places where we were seeking collection, not just of race, but also gender, of LGBTQ status, of language access, because we know that the intersectional nature of identities can often mean compound differences. So people don't exist in discrete buckets necessarily, right? We know that the disability community has been hit particularly hard by COVID-19 because COVID-19 thrives in what we call congregate settings. So those are nursing homes, those are homes for folks, residential facilities for home, for folks with disabilities. And so when we're thinking about this, it's certainly true that there are different ways in which, and there are complex ways in which class and gender and race come together, but that we know that if you are Black and, if you are Brown and, if you are Indigenous and, you know, these other identities, you are facing numerous hurdles. And so we're trying to focus and recognize those pieces. We talked a little bit about education, but we know that students with disabilities are at a real disadvantage because many of them, the disabilities center around their ability to process reading and verbally. So going to an entirely remote setting puts them at a real disadvantage. We know that the digital divide affects low-income students of color and especially low-income Black and Brown students. So those are the pieces that we're thinking about. And I think part of what we're trying to do and that must be done as we think about long-term solutions is ensuring that we have input and that we're in conversation with and lifting up the voices of impacted communities because they are going to be able to tell us what they need. And that is what we've been seeing. We've been seeing Black and Brown communities leading these protests. And we've been seeing people joining them and backing them up and lifting them up. And certainly the ACLU as a national organization has been trying to do that. We recently released a blog post by Patrice Cullors, who's the one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement, and trying to ensure that we offer a platform for those voices and that we're listening to and understanding how we can address these problems and these solutions.
So for another question, I think many people now understand the importance of state and local governments in a way that we didn't before, in the way that have appreciated the response to the pandemic that we've seen from state and local elected officials more than we have the response we've seen on the federal level. So one of the questions is focused on the election cycle. And as we vote in our local and state elections, what criteria is helpful to help identify candidates who are going to strive for greater racial justice and equity?
Sure, so we need to be thinking about issues. We need to be thinking about divesting from our criminal legal system and from police and investing in those services and benefits, education, mental health crises, services. We need to be thinking about social work and how we can, and again, this requires community input and response because we don't want those decisions about, as we make decisions about divesting from policing and moving to other community-based services, that we're not moving to services and systems that are putting these communities at a disadvantage. For example, we've heard from many communities that what they don't need are more oversight and surveillance of family relations, of removing children from homes. What they do need are adequate childcare, affordable childcare. And so that's why it's so important that we're hearing from communities and thinking about the issues that we respond. And that may vary, you know, depending on where you are. But I think it's important that we cut back on funding for the criminal legal system, and we are investing in education. We're investing in bridging the digital divide. We're investing in healthcare and health services. And those are really going to be informed by listening to the communities on the ground, the communities that are most affected.
So the next question is about moving together in unity towards this goal of racial justice. And the question is, how do we get all organizations, community advocates, government systems, et cetera, on the same plan to execute strategies with reparative concessions?
With reparative?
Concessions.
Reparative concessions. I think we all would like that. I think that's probably hard to pull off, but that doesn't mean
that's a $1 billion question.
Right, exactly. But we've never needed that to move things forward. We have been able to push things forward with passion, with power, and understanding who are the key decision makers, because we may not be able to get that. We may not be able to get everyone on the same page, but we can certainly identify key needs and key victories. One in this moment is that we absolutely are spending far, far too much on policing in our communities. And that money is sorely needed. It was needed before the pandemic. It will be needed even more. I've had conversations with educators who are concerned about trauma, who are concerned about students returning in the fall having experienced. We have all experienced a trauma, but that is being particularly felt by certain communities. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be, we need to find ways and commonalities about prioritizing, even with those we disagree with. And we may agree that less government spending, we can find allies on either side of the aisle who agree that we're spending too much on law enforcement, and agree that we do need to be investing in our kids. We need to be investing in the folks who have been marginalized and who have been criminalized, if we want them to be successful in their return home. And thinking about what are the services they need. Do these barriers that we've created, the more than 50,000 collateral consequences for folks with criminal records, does that really help us? Does that really set people up for success? Of course not, it doesn't. And so we know that people will need to have access, for instance, to medical care and health insurance if we're all going to be safe. And so those are the ways that we can think about it and push a critical mass to make long-lasting changes.
Mm-hmm. And I'll also just mention that I've always had a concern that after there's a high-profile incidence of racial injustice or of some type of other social justice challenge, that all the resources will flow to that particular issue,
yes.
Not remembering that there are multiple avenues of inequality that led to that moment. And so although we all want to be on the same page with the goal of being racial justice and equity, that we can't abandon all of the work,
exactly,
that we're doing in the other spheres. Like we still need to, even if we want criminal justice,
right,
criminal legal system reform, we need to think about education. We need to reform housing. We need to think about economic opportunity and building up strong and vibrant communities. But all of those things will ultimately come together to work to achieve the end goal of racial justice.
Right, and it can feel hard, and we often want, well, what's the one thing I can do today? And there are certainly things that we can start to do today, but for this problem is generations and hundreds of years in the making, and we are not going to solve it with a single thing, and we need many people working on many fronts to really bring about lasting and deep change.
And I've really appreciated that you've talked about segregation, because segregation is at the core of so many of the challenges that we're seeing, that it facilitates inequalities in education. It facilitates racialized policing. But it is one, yes, of the issues that I don't hear discussed often enough, that doesn't get the attention and resources that it really warrants because of how core it is to all of the inequality that we see.
No, and it, to your point, it facilitates, and I think it makes it easier for us to justify just the very different reality that particularly low-income Black and Brown communities live in, because they really don't understand what it's like to be stopped every single time you leave the house if you are a young Black or Brown man. They really don't understand what it's like to be unable to find quality childcare and be able to work, and to be penalized for either not working or for not finding adequate childcare for your children. They really don't understand what it's like to attend a school where the ceiling is falling in, where you can't drink the water. And it makes it out of sight, out of mind. And so, you know, I strongly believe that segregation creates literal distance, but also mental distance for those of us who are able to take steps to make changes and are in decision-making authority for many of the resources that can make a community thrive. And so I think that is why we do have to tackle that and keep that at the fore as we think about these issues and how we really turn a corner here.
So the next question I think goes to an issue that we've been grappling with since 1954 in the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And that's, how do we fix racial disparities and segregation and inequality in education? And a related question, how can anti-racism teachings be implemented in the curriculum, more infused throughout the school?
Sure. Well, that can happen. We look to leadership, and that can happen in a centralized way, where school systems are adopting racist teaching histories that have previously been ignored or disregarded. It can happen at the individual school level. It can happen at multiple levels. It really doesn't have to be, nor should it be, solely the responsibility of a single actor in our public school system. But we want to make sure that those are done right, done well. And I think about, you know, I clerked for Judge Robert Carter, who was one of the lead attorneys in the Brown versus Board of Education. And he said, you know, the work is not done. And he was very quick to recognize the pervasiveness of white supremacy, and that even when we have a win in hand, that doesn't necessarily mean that we can rest on our laurels, and that we need to continue to watch and check. And so even if kids are in the same building, are they in the same classes? Are they getting the same services? Are they getting the same quality of instruction? Or are they being tracked? Or do we have, you know, when we look in the building, it's diverse, but when we look in individual classrooms, we've got gifted and talented track that is predominantly white, as happens here in New York City, where I live. And then you've got Black and Brown kids disproportionately on remedial tracks, receiving specialist services that are generally under-resourced. Are those kids being over-disciplined, the Black and Brown kids being over-disciplined? We're seeing, you know, the criminalizing of adolescent behavior. We've got litigation in North Carolina and South Carolina where, you know, basic adolescent behavior, walking away from someone, not talking, walking, cursing, are criminalized and are a reason to arrest or put a young person into the criminal justice system. And that's just not where we should be. So it's important to think about how we make our schools adopt anti-racist curriculums, but we can also stop punishing our kids and criminalizing our kids and not acknowledging those. And as, you know, as someone who has a 14-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 5-year-old in the house, I can say that teenagers are not always so gracious. And that doesn't mean that they're criminal. That doesn't mean that they should be locked up or arrested. And there are far better ways. And we see those ways. You know, it's not like we don't know they exist. These are the ways that kids in affluent communities, that white children are dealt with. So we know that it can happen and it exists. And so the question is, are we going to commit to making that a reality for all children?
And I think it connects back to your earlier statements about stereotypes, about the criminality of Black folks. Because either you look at our system of public education and you think that it is deeply and profoundly flawed and unjust and needs to be rebuilt, or you believe in the worst stereotypes about of Black and Brown children about their regarding their criminality and their ability and their and their potential. So it sounds like you're saying that we need to look at education system from top to bottom, and to identify all of the pieces that feed that inequality. It's not just about where we live. It's about systems and structures that at every stage are separating and treating our Black and Brown kids differently.
Exactly. And so it's not just a piece, it's not just infusing anti-racist curriculum in our textbooks and in our teachings for students and teachers, although that is an important piece, but it's about also recognizing the bias that educators might bring, or having controls within the system to recognize when we've got differential outcomes for students because of race, and what we can do to provide positive supports for those students, and how can we counterbalance and create checks for kids so that where they're all getting the service and support that they need to thrive.
So the next question is focusing on George Floyd, and asks, because deaths like George Floyd's happen every minute around the world, what kind of actions can artists or the South by Southwest Festival take to help us become more equal?
Sure. I mean, you know, as someone who had as a ritual seeing movies with my dad growing up, you know, the power of movies, the power of storytelling. We are a nation, we love our movies. We may be watching our movies remotely on Netflix, but we still love them. And I think that the need for more stories that humanize people of color, in particular Black people, and recognize the wide stretch of humanity that they display and feel. As someone who was a nerd, I can say, you know, there are Black nerds, there are, you know, and recognizing that these different aspects of society that have, I think, historically have been deeply underrepresented in our art and our storytelling need to be diversified. I think we can think about in terms of, you know, so there's storytelling. I am a big movie buff. I don't get to watch them nearly as much as I used to, but there are other ways that we can think about normalizing Blackness, normalizing humanity for those beyond just seeing white faces, but really thinking about the other aspects. Someone talked about intersection. One of the questions was about, what about class? What about disability? What about our LGBTQ folks? Then we can tell stories that put those, and it's not, they're not in the story because of that difference, but they are included, and we are able to recognize that we're not othering people, that there's not this vast gulf between us. But there may be differences that we need to account for and recognize. And I think art has a way of doing that and a power to do that seamlessly that really touches people and reaches people where they are, even without them knowing it. Because many of these biases, you know, are a function, frankly, of our entertainment system and our entertainment structure and the stories that are told repeatedly about Black criminality. And, you know, and we think about those realities.
I think I tend to see stories either about Black criminality at one end of the spectrum or at the other end of the spectrum that really focuses on Black victimization, on slavery, for example. And there is a wide range in between. And I think we could benefit from stories that just tell the everyday lives of Black folks, and to kind of, as you say, tell the full spectrum, stop focusing on those two extremes.
Right.
But not only, I know artists have more opportunity than we think to help tell the stories and push the narrative, but to engage in the actual social justice work that is going on every day, to lend their voices, their skills, their knowledge to support the organizations that are working to try to change the narrative.
I think that's right. And we need, at every step of the storytelling, so that's writers, you know, that's not just the people in front of the camera, that's the directors, the writers, I think the industry at large, recognizing that those voices need to be in the decision-making room, they need to be in the room of shaping those stories and thinking those through. And I think we simply don't have enough of that. Mm-hmm. And so that those are ways that we can have a huge impact on public perception and public understanding of color and Blackness. And we shouldn't let those opportunities pass.
So this question is related and going back to education, and it's how should we focus the energy and voice of K through 12 students who want to get involved in local initiatives to fight for racial justice and equity? And here in New York City, there are just tremendous youth-run, student-led organizations like Teens Take Charge that are out there every mm-hmm. day being creative and relentless in demanding equality. So there are organizations like that, but what are the spectrum of ways that we can get students involved in fighting for their own rights?
So it's funny, I was gonna say, I think we should shut up and listen to them because they often have the energy and the vision that we've been in this fight so long, we might not even be able to see. The ACLU has an institute, an advocacy institute for high school and college students. And so I've had the opportunity to meet with them even during this time remotely. And just the energy and passion and thought, I've spoken to young folks who, they're now 17, but they've been organizing and going to protest since they were 12, and they, their level of sophistication should not be underestimated. Mm-hmm. I remember hearing Stevie Wonder say that the problem with young people is old people. And the idea of being able to support and lift up, and they can often see what those of us who are older are like, well, that can't happen because we've got, and I think what we can do is certainly help to facilitate and mentor. And so one of the ways that we do that is sharing with them sort of how things have traditionally worked without saying this is the only way that it can be done. Right. So that can happen through mentoring, that can happen through the support of youth leadership development organizations. Like as Deborah, you mentioned one, I used to be on the board of an organization called the Resilient Advocacy Project that did youth leadership training for low income youth who had faced adversity. We can support through our dollars, we can support through our time. And we can create and support systems that allow for youth voices to be heard and to be able to offer up input. And I think those are some of the ways they will often rise to the challenge. Mm-hmm. And so this is not a question of, this is not like you all should care about this. There's no question that passion, that investment is already there. Particularly for the groups that have been most marginalized. And so, I think we sometimes just need to get out of their way, but there are other ways that we can offer supports that I've named too.
So for the next question, I think we've seen lots of corporations issue statements of support that saying Black Lives Matter or supporting protests and wanting a police accountability. And one of the questions is, will those statements of support turn into to action? So how should organizations actively work towards improving racial justice? And very importantly, how can their employees hold them accountable for turning those statements of support into action? I would say both externally and also internally, because some of these corporations who have said Black Lives Matter and we want to support the community, when you look at their board of directors, there are no people of color. When you look at their executive levels, there are no people of color. When you look at the corporation, the other companies that they do business with, there aren't minority and women-owned businesses in that group. So what should organizations be doing, and how can people who work for those organizations make sure that they're doing that?
Right. I mean, I think we're seeing employees feeling empowered to speak up. I think there are a couple different ways. You've named some of them. I mean, we need to demand specific commitments and measurable ways to determine progress. There's certainly intangibles that we will look to and try to assess, but there can be very clear markers of, is this company making progress? You know, we know what your board looked like in January of 2020. What does your board look like, you know, a year from now? What do your C-suite positions look like? What are the promotion tracks? How are you retaining how are you retaining workers of color? And workers who have historically been marginalized? And part of that too, we'll be thinking about for those employees that companies have been particularly poor at recruiting and retaining, there simply may not be enough of them in the building to make a meaningful difference. So then in those instances, look to outside assistance and help and be willing to recognize, like, we have done such a poor job, you know, of hiring and retaining disabled workers that we don't have any to ask, how do we do this better? And so there are organizations, there are groups who are willing to help identify why that is. You know, it may be that your hiring and application process doesn't allow for differently abled people. Mm-hmm. You know, it may be that there are, you know, certainly, you know, what we've done is we've gone through and looked at our job postings, and are we alienating potential applicants with language without intending to? So there are a number of different ways to hold people accountable, but I do think that there need to be a diverse range of employees within the company. I think they need to, there need to be clear, measurable goals of progress and timelines for that progress. And even if the marks aren't hit, which, you know, is a reality, I think we need to also recognize, what do we do if those marks aren't hit? How do we assess what went wrong? How do we improve and ensure that we stay committed? And it's not just in this moment when there's so much energy, there's so much attention, there's so much pressure. But really, as we move farther away from this, as the attention and the pressure dies away, what can we go back to and look to see, have we done the things we said we would do?
So I'm going to move to what I'm going to call the speed round. We have just a few minutes left, but lots and lots of good questions. So I'm going to try to get through as many of those questions as possible. So I'm going to ask the question, ask you to give relatively short responses so we can get
all of them.
First is, how can non-Black organizations start this process when they do not even understand or recognize the historical inequities? For example, the healthcare experimentation, that history that shapes some of the inequality?
I think start talking, looking for organizations. There are actually a wide range of organizations that are happy to work to educate people. I think there, you know, there are books. If you think about how you learn about many things, there are books you can read, there are documentaries, there are many different ways that this process can begin. But I think that there are certainly like wide range of organizations that are happy to work with organizations. If the barrier and the obstacle is, for instance, to hiring, there are consulting organizations who can help to identify ways to change the way that you're posting your jobs and how can you improve diversity. I think in terms of the work, and if you're an organization that's thinking about the programmatic work, go back to the communities that you were supposed to be working on behalf of and think about how you designed those programs. Did you talk to those communities in the beginning of your process, or did you come to them with a service? Because often that's kind of how that process happens, where a group of people who are not at all affected by a process come up with a solution and then offer it up without any accountability. And I totally exceeded my speed round, so I'm gonna
do that. Speed round. So we all, I think, saw with heartbreak some of those photos from the election yesterday, the long line, people being turned away. And think back to Bloody Sunday, and that people put their lives on the line so that folks have the ability to vote. What we're seeing is voter suppression. So one of the questions is asking, what can someone, an everyday person on the ground, do to ensure fair elections on a local level?
Sure. So they, you know, I've been involved in previous elections. There's election protection efforts. There are efforts to do poll watching, to be a poll volunteer. And you can typically, to be a volunteer at a local voting site requires you to go to your local election board. But then there are organizations, the ACLU is linked to organizations that can do election watching, election. Like I said, I have been involved in efforts called election protection. But there are ways that you can certainly, again, contact your local ACLU. We have ACLU affiliates in every state, three in California. So that is one way to start. And then there are generally efforts to do poll watching to sign up voters. And those can be done even in socially distant ways. There are people who are thinking about these efforts. And so I think we should absolutely find ways to get involved and ensure the integrity of our system, because to your point, Deborah, like, we know that there's active voter suppression going on. And when you see it online or in person, report it, elevate it, call it out.
Right. And related to that, I think, is to pay attention. One thing that we lost when we lost Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was the requirement that jurisdictions publicize changes that they were going to make to election procedures, changes to polling places. And so now it's up to everyday citizens to keep an eye on that, to watch when they're making changes that may result in voter suppression, and to publicize that, to call them out on that, and to challenge that. I'm gonna try to combine two questions. And one is asking whether immigrants are in greater risk of ICE right now, considering the Black Lives Matter protests and that many took part in them nationwide. Are they going to be at greater risk of being detained by ICE? And a related question is trying to move beyond the discussion of Black versus white. And you mentioned earlier on that there are fewer statistics out there. We know that Native communities, we know that Latinx communities were also disproportionately impacted, but we don't have that data. And so this person wants to know what we can do to move beyond that Black versus white discussion and focus on other groups as well that are impacted by racial inequality.
So I think, again, part of it is pushing for better data collection, right? So we can talk about those things. I think increasing language inclusivity and access is certainly one way. In terms of the first part of that question, and are immigrants at greater risk? I think certainly there are immigrants are absolutely a population that can be at greater risk, and particularly Black and Brown immigrants, right? We know that we see Black immigrants, even though they make up a relatively small fraction of immigrants overall, that they are much more likely to be put into removal proceedings because of heightened contact with the police. And that's true for Latinx immigrants as well. So again, those intersectional identities, we shouldn't be thinking about these as isolated identities that expose people, but they're also often overlapping. And ACLU has been working to also, and I talked about getting folks out of jails and prisons, we've also been working to get folks out of ICE detention facilities for the same reasons. And I think we need to, we live in a diverse country, and we want to be thinking about and talking about the different ways that people experience difference, and when those differences put people at a disadvantage. And I think that, you know, that feeds into our storytelling, talking about things differently as well. So I'm gonna stop there.
Well, so for the last question, people want homework. So what are the one or two books that you would recommend that folks read to continue to learn about and understand some racial inequality?
Good. So let's see, we've got, you put me on the spot. So
there, you got 30 seconds. This is a super speed round.
Right, exactly. So there are really good books on housing segregation, and one is by Beryl Saturn. I'm not remembering the name of it. I don't know if Deborah remembers. I'm actually gonna throw it to Deborah. Because, well, you are the
person. Okay, so I would say The Color of Law on on housing segregation.
Okay.
Of course, the new Jim Crow stamped.
And
is a good book as well. White Fragility is a good book as well.
That's why you get a professor.
So I think our time is up. I want to thank you, Renika.
Thank you.
For all of this, for helping us understand what we're seeing in the news and going a little deeper than just the statement that these communities are disproportionately impacted.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks to everyone who's joining us.